Okay. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the panel this morning. I'm really excited to be talking about this subject because it's something very, very near and dear to my heart, and I think to all of us. And I think it's especially relevant for this conference and this day and age and the work that we do. So to start out with, I just wanted to go through a quick introduction. So my name is Corey Chandler, and I'm a lead interaction designer at eBay, where I've been there for 4.5 years. And I specialize, my focus is in the search and the finding experience. And we'll just go down and introduce everybody else on the panel.
Hello, my name is Mike Alpern. I'm a design director at Yahoo. I work in the search team on social search problems, including Yahoo Answers and a variety of other things in core search.
Hi, and I'm Elliot Schmuckler, principal product manager at LinkedIn. And I worked on most of the LinkedIn site, including the LinkedIn homepage, profile, search, and other elements. And happy to be here.
Good morning. My name is Chris Milliwatt, and I lead the product team at a company called Views. It's the largest distributor of high-definition video online. Check it out. Good morning. Thanks for coming.
My name is Jake Cressman. I'm a producer at Electronic Arts. I mostly work on building features for building social networks around casual games.
Great. So I think to start out with, I just want to make sure that people get a brief introduction to what is A/B testing. I think some people might be familiar with it, but essentially what it is the idea is it's a way to achieve kind of an optimal design through testing of alternative designs to a lot of traffic. It's the sort of thing, it's a capability available to us via the web that other places are maybe not more limited. So, for things like actual physical products, you can't really do this, but for the web, you can because you have so much traffic. And so the idea is that you have one design that might work for something and maybe another design and maybe another design. And you can use the metrics that you get by diverting small amounts of traffic to each one of these to sort of to measure and see which one is the most successful. And actually, if I could get a quick show of hands, who currently practices A/B testing at where they're working? Okay.
Wow.
Great. Well, good. I think you'll get a kick out of this talk then. So to start out with, I wanted to go give a few examples of this because it's kind of a fun thing to do. And if you already know this, don't cheat. But so I wanted to show you a couple of examples about of A/B tests that have been done. And it gets at sort of the heart of what this discussion is about. So the first one that I'll show here is around this. It's a foot care website, and this is the checkout portion of their flow. And the idea, if you look over here on the left, this is the it's a kind of typical checkout flow. The main difference between these two is you can see there's this coupon code that they're introducing. The thought is that before they have this checkout, and that's fine, but if they had a coupon campaign where they can put out advertising and they can have coupons in it, and that this will improve the checkout metrics for what they're doing. So that's really what the main difference between these two different pages. And so can I get a quick show of hands as who, if you think about which is a better conversion rate, who believes that the one on the left is actually going to be performing better? Okay. Now, how about the one on the right? All right. Well, so you'd be correct. So the one on the right actually performed more poorly, and when they did an analysis of this as to why, what they seem to think that it came down to is that essentially people are all ready to go to buy something, and they see this coupon code, and they say, oh, maybe I should get a coupon code. They pop up a new window. They do a search for the coupon code. They can't find one online, and they think, man. Now other people are getting a better deal on this thing than I am. And so they start reconsidering it, whereas before it was just straight ahead. And it's tough because I'm sure when you think about this, each company thinks about the benefit of having coupons and they can do advertising and things like that. But in this case, it actually had a negative effect on the design. So the next one I'm going to show is an example from Microsoft. And I had to kind of recreate this because it was just described. But essentially, it was for reviewing the helpfulness of articles that were on their site. And so the left side, essentially, it says, hey, was this article helpful or not? And you say yes or no. And then if you say that, it's like, well, can you tell us why? And then instead, what they've tried through A/B testing is to do the right-hand side, where the thought is that they can use kind of the Netflix-esque mouse over and clicking on the feedback stars, and then you can explain why. And it's a shorter flow, and that hopefully gives a little bit more granular feedback. Now, when you look at sort of which design will have a better response rate, Which one would you say that performs better? Can I get a show of hands for the left-hand side? Okay, and then how about the right-hand side? Okay, so the way that this one came out is it netted out that the left one actually performed better. The original one that they did performed better. And when they got down to why, and I think this is an interesting theme that you'll see later, the desire to know why. Why did this happen? And basically what it came down to, or what they believe, is that even though this one was technically a longer flow, essentially, whether something helped you or not is kind of, for people, a black or white sort of thing. Either I got the answer that I wanted, or this really didn't help me. And introducing this granular feedback maybe wasn't really wasn't suitable, and maybe it was faster for people to just to make this binary decision. And so as a result, the left-hand side actually performed better. Now, I've got one more example to show you, but you have to bear with me because I know it's a little bit early, but this is about registered sex offenders. And I found this article online that has a few different examples of this. And so essentially what this is a design, and I know it's kind of small, but it's essentially trying to get people concerned about the sex offenders that might be in their area. And if you can just pay us some money, we'll give you information about where those guys are so you can protect yourself. And so the goal here is to get people to buy this information. And so if you look, there's three different possibilities. And so this is kind of the original design of it. And so you can see, the information about what's in your area. And it's saying, hey, look, here's all these great features that we're going to give you. If you pay us this money, we're going to give you photos. We're going to give you all these details. We'll plot it on a map. We'll, give you MapQuest directions. And then please fill out this information. And we've got testimonials and sort of background over here. Now, in this design, what they did is a lot of the shift was in layout, so they kind of tightened it up more. And then if you look, one of the other things which was introduced is they have this idea of, would you like names, pictures, and addresses? Click here. And if you look in the third design, what they've done is they've tried to sort of design it in a way where the left-hand side's got that key information, but the right-hand side's sort of saying, hey, here's what you're getting, and so supporting you as you go through this flow. So if your goal was to sell as many as possible of these, this registered sex info packets, can I get a show of hands for who thought the original design would perform the best? Okay. Now, how about this second design here? And how about the third design here? Okay. So the one that actually performed the best was the second one. And this one was hard for me to deal with, too, because I feel like visually, the third design was much more tight, and it was more compelling from a presentation standpoint. But what they, a lot of this is speculation, but what they people were saying in terms of what would, contributing to this was this idea of having the single call to action, that it was compelling for people in this flow. But I think the other thing that this will point out, is some of you might be thinking, is like, well, what's the background behind this? What exactly did this do? Why do they have that here? Is there some sort of like, is it less information if they click that? Or and some of this you kind of need more context, which I think is also important to the discussion that we're about to have. So I wanted to show some of these examples to you to give you some of the sense of what how this thing sort of goes. And I wanted to start talking now to open it up to this actual discussion around some of the key issues that I see around A/B testing. So give me a second so I can unplug my notes. But the first thing I wanted to ask, especially in the context of all this, is that what we've been doing is essentially looking at these designs and saying, okay, well, I think this one will do better. I think, oh, it didn't do better, dang it. And so one question I have for folks or for the panelists is, do you think that it is the job of product designers and interaction designers to be able to predict the outcome of the designs that they are proposing? Or is that somehow not really what our job is?
All right, I can be first. So my answer is probably going to be unexpected. I would say, yes, it is the job, but it's also an impossible job, right? So I think, yes, it is the job of designers to say, this is probably a better design. But as we showed through some of the examples, especially the sex offender one, it's nearly impossible to be right every time, right? Even with significant expertise, even with domain expertise in the area that you're building the functionality in. So that's why, despite it being the job, you can't rely on that as the single predictor of what's going to be good and what's going to be not. You have to test it. That's the only way you confirm
it. Yeah. I think a part of it, too, I agree, Elliot, actually. but I think part of it is what level of resolution can you know your rightness? I mean, I can say that I like design A better than design B, but I don't know that it's 32.4% better, right? Or it's better in Australia, right? Or it's better because of these factors in a reliable way. I think that what testing can do is provide a lot more level of precision in that, you know, verification or validation of the decision or the opinion.
I'd say that it's at least partly that it is the job of the designer in the sense that it's important, I think, as a field that we begin to build up a set of heuristics that we feel that we can use reliably to predict these things. And that if you're experiencing a new domain for the first time, you might not know. And in the same, it's actually, I think, quite similar to usability testing, right? In the sense that it is an important tool for beginning to build up a heuristic so you have a model internally of what works and what doesn't, and then why.
Well, to give some context for this, actually, I have a quote from an article that's online about that I read. It was called "How Netflix Designs a Winning Website." And one of the quotes that they had from it that really struck me was one of the lead designers said, "We don't assume anything works, and we don't like to make predictions without real-world tests. Predictions color our thinking." And so, to me, this kind of runs against what you guys are saying. And so, I guess what I would ask is, if you think it really is, we can't always be right, but it is part of our job. Then, I guess I would ask, like, when you guys recruit designers, do you give them three designs and say, "Hey, which one did best?" and use that as a criterion as to whether or not you'd hire them?
No, but what I was saying is, I think it's part of the job, but I don't expect people to be able to do that part of the job, right? I think they develop that skill over time, and designers become better at that over time, as Micah was pointing out, in terms of developing those heuristics and learning the domains. But certainly a new designer, right, never designed in that domain before, has no idea, right? They can't be trusted to make that judgment. That's why you institute a culture of testing like Netflix.
Well, and I think part of Netflix is kind of crap, right? Because what it's saying is that they didn't make any choices before they put out designs. And the truth is, they had 100 designs and they picked 10. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And then 9 of them failed, as they say, but they made choices. I think they're just trying to be a little sensationalist, or they were taken out of context if you're to believe that they didn't make choices. Because I think that whether we call them heuristics or, you know, intuition, or, you know, maybe you don't know exactly the framework, but I think it's kind of crap to think that, you know, monkeys design, you know, threw some features onto a page and then they put it out in the world, right? They came with a point of view, right? And that point of view, whether it's design principles or intuition specifically, I think that you're starting from somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's right that you can't test everything. Right? Yeah. You can't test every choice that you're likely to make on a page. So you're starting off from some constraint set that was based on some opinion or some set of heuristics, right? Now, testing just gives you a way to refine that down even further without relying on just the heuristics, which may be wrong.
Well, it sounds like what I hear you guys saying is that it is part of the job, but a lot of the challenge that we're faced with, especially when we're evaluating those designs, is that we weren't involved in the process at all. And so theoretically, you know, if you are involved as a designer in these projects, you have some of the context of the background around, like, what is involved with help articles. You've been involved in some of the research and seeing, like, what other sites are doing. Maybe you have a better understanding, or even e-commerce. You have a sense for, because surely other sites have also tried this idea of using coupons and face sort of similar dilemmas. And if there was a process involved here that was maybe involved in evaluating, then you would have the context to be able to make that decision better than just sort of blindly looking at something on screen and making a gut level decision.
I wouldn't say it's a gut level decision or it's intuition. It seems like every designer brings their toolbox of heuristics to a design problem. And what's interesting is what's in your design, what's in your heuristic toolbox, and is it made for, say, a problem in China, or is it made for a problem in Australia? And, you know, by the way, where do our design heuristics come from and how are they validated? Seems like now they're just kind of passed down from one book to the next and from one blog to another. And A/B testing is one thing I think is good about it, is it gives us a chance to reevaluate some of the assumptions that we're making. And in the heuristics that we use.
Well, you're touching on the next subject I wanted to get to, which is essentially this question of expertise. And when you're talking about like people's heuristics and their skills, that's what it comes down to. And there's this, I have another quote from a different article. It's by Nick Usborne of A List Apart. And it's an article that's called Design Choices Can Cripple a Website. And basically, the quote is, one way or another, it's important to accept that none of us, neither designers nor writers, know what the best page design or copy is until we test. In a business environment where marketers demand an accountable performance from every web page, it's time to put aside the assumed expertise of design and copy gurus. And so I think this is challenging some of the stuff that we're talking about. And I wanted to get at this question of expertise, but then also to discuss one of the dilemmas that I think is a theme of A/B testing that is one of the challenges that companies are faced, at least that I've gone through as well, where I think my sense is that designers, when they're faced with the opportunity of A/B testing, what's enticing to them is this idea of being able to test their radical designs and to try to finally get a chance to see, you know, will my design idea work? But what ends up happening is that this sort of concept of there are no real experts means that suddenly it's an open playing field. And I think one of the challenges that's especially particular to interface design is that its nature makes it very accessible to everybody. It's very easy for somebody to come in and say, I think that button should be on the right side, or I think that this should be here, I think this should be here, in a way that a lot of other fields can. I mean, you're not going to have some executive going into a developer and say, hey, I think you should use this code structure instead of this code structure, use this, because it's not accessible to them. But the nature of what we do is sort of available to everybody. And one of the dangers that can be introduced by A/B testing is that you can have everybody trying out their own ideas with an equal weight in terms of like what will actually get built, and you can end up with designers who are spending their time, you know, cranking out the designs of others rather than being able to have a weight on their own opinion, because, you know, theoretically that's why they're hired. This is what they do. This is their expertise. So
I don't know. I think the way that I've been thinking about what you're just talking about is like you can't crowdsource design. Or at least the thought around everyone contributing to a design process makes it better, I think, has limited applications, right? I think that it's arguable if a minimalist design like the iPod interface or the iPhone would have been created by a crowd, because a lot of people would have wanted a lot of things, right? And so it would have perhaps, by definition of the crowd's needs, would have been this humongous thing, or at least feature-rich thing. I think that A/B testing, or the contributions of what a test can bring, can really help you optimize, but it can't help you kind of revolutionize or kind of go step functions beyond, right? It's helps you optimize it at the micro level much more, right? Is two columns better than one? Right, is a button better than three buttons? Is a coupon thing better than not? Not let's completely change the flow, right, and be able to see, you know, to make a revolutionary change, I think takes a little bit more than just these micro tests.
Corey, what you described is exactly what happened to me the first time I tried A/B testing. And it was a situation where we wanted to find out how to integrate ads on a page and what was going to be the most effective. And I thought it would give me an opportunity to try to explore some interesting ideas, you know, try different things out. But it turns out it was more like the PM just said, let's put the ad over here on top of the toolbar. Let's put the ad down here in the footer. Let's put it in the search results. Let's put it. And it turned out to be, you know, 20 different variations that, and a lot of them were just completely absurd. And I'd say, why do you want to do that? And the answer would be, well, it's just a test. Let's just throw it up there and see if it gets results. And so it was a huge pain in the butt. And I ended up making, you know, zillions more mocks than I would have ordinarily. And what it came back was is sometimes the really, really absurd ideas were effective, but we had no idea why. And we had no, you know, basis of comparing the other ones. And we also knew there were definitely things that we didn't want to do for other reasons.
I think that comes back to to Corey's point about the difference between an expert or a novice who's merely using testing as their North Star, that you may get a solution, but it's about depth of analysis. Do you have a model that explains why something is true? because that's how you get to the revolutionary perspective. Because you need to understand not just what is the surface level metric, but what is the underlying goal of the user. And that's where everyone can bring creativity to the problem to say, what's a better solution for how to get at this fundamental underlying problem?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I think a lot of these fears of kind of A-B testing being, you know, leading to let's test the link in every possible location and see what happens, right, are just overblown, because you don't have typically the resources to do every possible test under the sun, right? You can only test so many things. Even in Jake's case, right, I'm sure there were 1,000 different ad placements and they probably only tested, you know, 20. Right,
about 60, but
all
still.
All right, more extreme than I thought. But still, you just can't test everything. So it can never become the kind of thing where you're trying every possible thing and there's no expertise required. It's always limited by expertise to some set. The other point that I think it's important to bring up, and this is in contrast to what I think what Chris was saying earlier, is A-B testing frequently for a small change doesn't show you any kind of impact on the numbers, right? You can move the link around anywhere you want, and people will still find it and click on it, and it doesn't show you any change in activity. You really have to make a pretty major change for you to be statistically significant in the A-B testing results. So a lot of the time, a lot of these small changes, and we went through a little test just a while back with LinkedIn where, you know, we moved a bunch of links around. Guess what? No change, right? You really have to make pretty big changes for A-B testing to actually show you whether it's better or worse.
Well, I'm not sure if I necessarily agree with that, because the thing is, if you look at some of the adjustments that are done, you know, when you think about, you know, the leading that's between the spacing between things, it can make the difference between whether or not something shows up above the fold or whether it shows up below the fold. And I think also what makes it so enticing for companies, and especially for a company like eBay, like even if we can move the needle like 0.003%, we have so many people accessing our site that it's very alluring to even get that little nudge in metrics. And what's especially enticing about it as well is that a lot of times these little tweaks are the ones that, well, hey, we could do this in just a week, and we could get this out to you so quick, and we wouldn't really change a whole lot for our users, and so we wouldn't have that kind of trouble. So the allure of that is very strong, and I think if I can keep throwing out quotes, I have one here that's from Brian Eisenberg from the Clicks Network, and it's from an article called "How to Decrease Sales by 90%," and he says, "Here's a quick refresher on making improvements to increase conversion rates. There are thousands of improvements, big and small, that you can make to improve your conversion rate. Nevertheless, you should focus on changing one thing at a time. Make one change, see that it gives you X percent increase in sales, then make another change." And this, it's getting at this idea of making these minute tweaks to the design to have these sort of smaller lifts. And I think what one of the issues that I've seen is that there's ramifications of this that are tough to wrestle with, where I think designers have a desire to really change the game or to make significant steps and not sort of continually focus on 60 different variations or you know, I too have struggled where I you know, for working on testing the finding interface, I had to design 32 different variants for what we were testing. And a lot of it was just, you know, do we put the ads here? Do we have left navigation? Do we have top navigation? Do we have this work? And the amount of time that you sort of spend focused on this, where if I could have taken that time and sort of thought about the larger issue, how much of a change could have been made. And in addition, I think that there's also a lot of overhead that comes from all these variants. I mean, if you think about, you know, the finding experience at eBay has a lot of people involved. I mean, you know whether it's product managers and business people. And so I think the other thing you have to bear in mind for folks who are considering using this is just the cognitive overhead that comes from this. I mean, I think for a lot of times, because of the simplicity of the site that we work on, we take for granted the shared understanding of what the design is and what will be. And I think even communicating what the design will be is a challenge enough. But it was sometimes hilarious to have these discussions about, you know, people would come to me and say, so what's finding going to look like? Well, let me show you this chart of 32 different variations. And I have to try to explain what are all the possible worlds that might exist? And it's amazing how hard it is to work within those realms of possibility until you've actually sort of narrowed it down to a more specific space.
But Corey, I mean, you were testing 32 variants because it was a big change, right? I mean, you were doing the extra work because the risk was so huge. I think it's justified in that case. Mm. I think if the finding flow for eBay is the core driver of all of its business, right? Most of the traffic comes through that flow as people look for things to buy, then any significant change to it should be tested, you know, in 32 variants, right? Or I don't know what the right number is, but should be tested extensively, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, and it sounds kind of dull. I mean, I think the core really of the issue, boring. Right, is it doesn't sound creative or doesn't feel creative. I mean, maybe it's necessary and perhaps 0.003% times 1 billion a day is a big number. But ultimately, I think, you know, you have to balance these incremental steps towards larger solutions and spend the time thinking about those larger changes, right? I think in conversation yesterday, thinking about like how an investment manager manages their portfolio, right? They have their set of investments, which include these small incremental ones, which have a high level of reliability that they'll be able to increase over a little bit of time. And then they've got a few holdings which have revolutionary sort of volatility and could give you the hit, right? But you have to balance those too. I think if you're just doing like small incremental changes and you're not looking towards a bigger 10% change, you know, then you're really just multiplying billion times 0.003. And I don't know if ultimately that's the right way to manage a product or a business if you're not looking at both shades of that problem.
Yeah, and it also depends on where you are, where your business is at, right? So sometimes even when you are multiplying times a billion, you know, I'm at Yahoo. We've got some stiff competition in search. If we keep doing small incremental changes, a billion times, whatever, not going to matter, right? So you've got to take risks. You've got to be willing to push the envelope to do things that are different. And just doing dozens of tests on should we have bullets, should we not have bullets, should the margins be 5 pixels, should it be this, that's not going to get you where you need to go.
Well, so it sounds like there's some consensus around a desire to also be focused on the larger changes. But I think one of the issues that I have is also around, is that even with the larger changes, can A/B testing really tell us what we need to know? And for this issue, I have another quote. It's from Jacob Nielsen, where he says, you know, putting A/B testing in its place. And what he says is A/B testing can only be used for projects that have one clear, all-important goal, that is to say, a single KPI, key performance indicator. Unfortunately, it's rare that such actions are a site's only goal. For many sites, the ultimate goals are not measurable through user actions on the server. And when I read this, it struck a note with me because of the fact that, you know, in the time that I've been involved in interface design, it seems like there's been a number of initiatives trying to find some way of quantifying and making a science out of what we do. Whether it's, you know, clinging to things like Fitt's law to say, oh my gosh, look, we have a law describing something about interface design, or thinking about the GOMS method of sort of measuring all these actions and sort of breaking it down to a quantifiable basis. And I think in the early days of the web, the thought was like, well, maybe it's number of clicks. You know, if only we could get number of clicks down to this very small number. But I think what we've found is that there are things beyond what you're measuring that are important, and it's especially hard for for the business to take grasp of this because they want something that's predictable. They want something that are actual numbers that they can interpret. But I think it doesn't pay enough attention to this idea that there's a larger issue at play of you know, are people enjoying their experience? Would they recommend this to somebody else? And can I get some of your thoughts around what are the cases where you think it is okay to be focused in on the quantitative metrics that A/B testing can provide versus when you have to really pay attention to the qualitative elements that are involved as well?
So, I mean, quite frankly, I think you always have to pay attention to the quantitative elements, right? If you're working on any kind of significant website, then there's always some underlying goal of that website that you have, right? For eBay, it's selling stuff. for LinkedIn, it's a bunch of things, but we like people to invite other people, right? That's one of our goals. For other sites that are more focused on content, it's getting people to view more content, right? There's always some goal. That's why you have the website, and that goal can be quantified. So at the very least, if you're considering a design change, you should test it to make sure that that one goal is not compromised. Now, that may not be, you may not be seeking to improve that base metric, right? You may not be seeking to improve how your site performs with that particular element. You may be seeking to increase, you know, return visits or something other than sort of the very basic quantifiable goal that you have. But still, you need to make sure that at the very least, you don't decrease the effectiveness that you set. You don't decrease your effectiveness at achieving the key mission of whatever it is that you're building.
But what if it's worth it? I mean, think about it. I remember that.
When is it worth it?
So I'm thinking about I don't know if anybody went to the Zappos presentation, but one of the things that he said was they got 25% of their revenue from dropshipping that was happening at other warehouses that weren't their own. But the thing is, when they did that, they had concerns about the customer experience. That things sometimes would take longer, and so they chopped off 25% of their revenue to sort of say, you know what, because we want to provide this experience for Zappos, we're willing to sacrifice that for our longer term vision. And so if you said, remember that we got this one metric we're focusing towards, that would have guided them not to do that. But I feel like
they used revenue as the one metric, right? Maybe they use customer satisfaction as their one
return
metric.
Return visits or something, yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't
have to be revenue, right?
But it's never one metric. And I don't even know, I mean, how are you going to measure all these things, like through surveys or through other sorts of ephemeral, I mean, how else are you going to be able to measure that?
There were metrics that you mentioned, like, are they willing to return? Are they, recommending it to friends? I mean, these are actual metrics that people are, qualitative qualities that are being quantified, right?
Absolutely. Although some of those longer term customer indicators are a little harder to measure. Like, you may get them per quarter, for example, if you do a survey, as opposed to the instantaneous data that you get on page views and so forth. So to me, the difference is between like measurement and metrics towards a goal. So if you become obsessed with the metric, then it can be perverted, particularly in a large organization where your individual reward structure is based on your success towards a metric. But if it's towards a goal.
And in the case of A/B testing, you don't look per quarter, you look every week, or you look every 3 days. So you don't get any measure of qualitative data out of that. You really don't get revenue data either. Yeah, but I just haven't seen it.
If your metric changes every quarter, or if your metric takes a quarter to get a readout, then you should run that test for a quarter.
Okay, well,
I'm still struggling with perverted metrics.
Perverted.
Okay, so another element to get to is this question of the impact that this can have on the future of design. And so, in terms of how are we going to grow, given that we have this tool available to us? And this tool can be abused, but it can also be used for good. And I guess one thing that I'm interested in is some speculation from you guys about how might the role of what we do as designers change in the future as product designers in general. As I thought about this, I was thinking, does this mean that in the future, maybe there is, for these small tweaks, are we just basically going to have something like a computer that would just basically go through all these small variants? So we're going to try this color for this button. We're going to try this color. We're going to try this color. We're going to try this color. We're going to try this spacing. We're going to try this sort of, maybe it works here. Maybe it works here. It works here. And now there's sort of an automated method for testing all these alternatives. And the job from a design standpoint is just sort of overseeing the machine that is kind of doing all these different variants of testing.
It sounds like that computer that guy had on Quantum Leap. Just occurred to me.
So, do you have a sense for what, if you take this, what we're wrestling with now, and apply that throughout the future, what might our jobs look like in the future?
Well, I want to take a slightly different approach to answer your question. I think that it shifts responsibility a little bit, that it requires validation. I think that where we're moving towards is that there's people seeking more predictability and more validation, and I think that that is ultimately good for design, right? I think that it's good to understand what works and doesn't work before you unleash it to a billion page views. I think it's ultimately good to shift the responsibility to the crowd to help answer that question. But I think what it feels like, though, is it's ultimately making us feel less creative. Like, just put it out there. You know, like Jake was saying, let's just put it in 20 places because we don't know or can't know. It doesn't feel like it's feeding the creative part of what our job has to be.
I mean, the part that I find exciting about the direction of where our jobs is going is that barriers to getting something that is as close to real, as close to what the final product will be, keeps coming down. So as prototyping tools get more and more sophisticated, and we have the ability to build, and the barriers to creating products get lower and lower, I think the idea of building it and experiencing it, I think there are a lot of things we can learn that we don't necessarily have to give it to 100,000 people to understand. But the difference between having a static mock-up or a picture on a whiteboard and having something that actually does what we want and that we can then use and then share with a appropriate size group given the question is exciting and I think is empowering for us.
Well, another question that I had around this idea of lowering the barrier to getting something out there and trying it, if we think that it's a valid idea, is especially around this concept of how do we decide what threshold of quality needs to go out there for this sort of experimentation. And so, it struck me because I read one of these articles that when they tried to sort of think of a historical element to A/B testing, and they cited an example of how it was discovered that. Citrus-based fruits were good for to address scurvy. And the way that it was done was that there's a captain who had this thought, like, you know, he thinks maybe this had something to do with it, but he wasn't sure. So when it went sailing, he gave half of his crew members fruit to address the issues of scurvy, and then half that he didn't. And he found, lo and behold, the ones that he gave the fruit to actually, you know, did better. But I couldn't help but think about those guys who didn't get the fruit. and this question has come up for me and in the context of A/B testing as well, and that scenarios have been brought up where we never had the intention of fully releasing it, but it would be maybe an interesting experiment to sort of just get data around. And some things about what was being proposed and some of the things that I think Jake was referring to about, you know, putting ad smack dab in the middle of a results set or even maybe even more fundamentally greater changes, which might yield some interesting results. But to me, what struck me about it was that this scenario seems similar to psychology, where they have this idea of a board of approval that you have to go through before you do any kinds of tests. You need to say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing. Do you think this is all right? And some powers that be say either, no, this is going to really mess some people up, so I don't care that you're only testing 10 people. This is just, it's not good to do to people. And there's some process by which you determine, okay, this is all right to try out. And I guess my question is, do you see a need for this sort of role of determining sort of a lowest threshold or a minimum requirement for what can be tested? And if so, where does that decision lie?
When death is not involved, probably you have a different level of threshold that you can consider. I mean, right, the scurvy example excluded. I think that I think it's good to understand where your thresholds are by being extreme. I mean, I think that if you don't know where the line is, then you're just not thinking outside of those boundaries. And I think A/B testing is an environment that allows you to safely test without killing anybody, if that's what the test requires.
It sounds like it would work in in the scurvy example, it's such a dichotomy, you know, either you're alive or you're dead. I just don't know of any problems like that where I work that are so defined and so, you know, the boundaries of it are so clear. And, you know, these other examples where it's either promotion code, no promotion code, and things like that, I don't really work on problems like that. I work on flows that have so many different boundaries and different triggers and different pitfalls that it seems like A/B test is almost too narrow. And so I definitely don't think I could approach any radical problem with A/B testing, because it's more like tuning or turning a fine knob to get just that one little increment better. And I just don't face problems like that often enough to make it worthwhile.
So, sorry, two thoughts. One, even if you're trying something radical, to Elliot's point, if you're going towards a goal, you got to know if the radical thing is better towards the goal or not. But back to the earlier point, from my perspective, the group that will oversee things is the market, in the sense that if companies don't treat their customers with respect, then they will lose. Now, if you're A/B testing, you know, if this evil thing or that evil thing, then that's a problem. If you're making an honest attempt to improve the user experience to help people achieve their goals, then, you know, it's great.
But who's to judge that, though? I mean,
I hope the people involved have a sense of if their thing is evil or not.
Well, I think the allure.
That's not always the case either, is it?
No, I mean, I think the allure of getting data about something, even when there is no intention to actually release it, is strong. And I think, although it depends on the field, but in at eBay, it's not exactly life or death, but we have a lot of people whose livelihood depends on the fact that they're able to sell their things on our site. And we have people who love our auctions, and they love the ability to be able to do this every day. And even if it is a small number of people, I can't help but think about those people that if we do try out these things, that how they're gonna feel and their impression of it, and then, you know, what are they gonna tell their friends, and it's I just think it's dangerous because it's such a small number. It seems tempting to give it a shot, but I worry about even those folks, and I'm not sure it's really clearly defined right now as to whose job it is to really watch out for that.
I'm just curious, how big are some of the A/B tests that have been done on this panel? Like how many people were involved in the test? If you know. You can say percentage.
So I know I've done tests where it's been in the millions.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what mine were as well. And it seems like when you're talking that number, that's a lot of people having a bad experience if one of your variations is putting an advertisement right in the middle of the content, for instance.
But, I mean, one reason I would question this kind of line of thinking is that they're having that bad experience, but they're having it for a limited amount of time, right? That's one of the virtues of A/B testing is usually it's pretty fast, right? You get it out there. You get the numbers, unless you have that metric that takes a quarter for you to get it. Usually you get the numbers in a couple of weeks. And if the test is really going poorly, you turn it off, right? That's what you're supposed to do. So it's rare that you're exposing a significant number of people to a bad experience for a long time.
I wholeheartedly disagree. So I have and a number of examples in the past. We have released designs on folks, and essentially it's switching out something that they're very used to, especially in the context of eBay. They're used to this, and they've been doing it for a long time. And so, the initial jar of when you swap out the family VCR with the TiVo, it's like I know how to program this thing, and like now you've changed it, and the initial groan from that. I think the idea of a burn-in period or a learning period is well known. And that really pushes against this whole idea of, oh, we can just put it out there for a little bit and then we can take it away. And we've seen a number of cases where at first the design first goes out and it's not doing well. And we're like, oh my gosh, this isn't going to work. What are we going to do? We spent all this time. But then as time passes, you start to see the metrics shift and actually and even improve. And so, and I think what you speak to also is another challenge that we face is a lack of a shared agreement as to what the agreed method of approach will be for doing these sorts of tests. You know, how long are we going to wait before we freak out about these metrics, and how long what are we willing to accept from that point? So I think we can't just sort of put these out for a little bit, and these could be very sustained experiences for people.
Well, I think ideally they shouldn't be, right? That was one of my points. Ideally, certainly if you're doing small tests, then there's no reason to expect that they're sustained, right? The kind of small tweaks that you were talking about, right? There's no reason to suspect that they would be a sustained experience. If you're doing a larger, much larger change, then yeah, maybe you expose people for longer, but that larger change you've probably also vetted in other ways, right? You've taken it through usability, you've shown it to people, right? So it's probably not evil, right? It may be worse than your current experience, but it's probably not a disaster.
It typically isn't a disaster. You have to admit that, yeah. It's a low-grade bad experience that people just put up with, and then they get over it when you turn it off. But there's one more issue I have with, you know, right in this area is that, you know, how much time should you have something up? And it seems like right now there's no standard for it, you know, to establish a good test duration. Or maybe there is. Maybe there is a good standard. But a lot of times when you put something new on a site, people poke at it because it's new. And it becomes significant, that just that poking, like, what is that? What's that new thing? And I haven't seen yet how that's accounted for, except when we review A/B test results, there's typically a user researcher in the room who says, well, don't forget they're probably just poking it because it's new. That's the best input we've had on that so far.
So, I mean, in some cases, for example, in Yahoo, we recently released new assistance layer, which provides information when you're searching with alternatives. And we made a conscious decision not to have it be something that's jammed in your face, right? So we have a quantified learnability scale to this in terms of first, how long does it take to get exposure to it? And then as you see it, how many impressions does it take before you understand it and you start to use it? And this was something that we came to through a combination of eye tracking, usability studies, and A/B testing. So, I think that's a point we've talked around a little bit, but the role of, we shouldn't, again, obsess about any given metric or any given method, that it's about a 360-degree view and pulling together all of the assets that you have to understand a problem.
That's hardcore.
Yeah, that sounds neat. I want one of those.
Well, with that, I wanted to make sure that we had enough time also to open this discussion up to everybody, because I think everybody has their own experiences with it that maybe they could share, or they can talk with, they can ask them any questions. So does anybody have any thoughts or questions about A/B testing that we can chat about?
Hey, I actually do a lot of work with the Eisenbergs at Future Now. So I'd like to hear what you guys think about sales funnels, like just in general, creating isolated environments for e-commerce.
Specifically, do you mean the idea of like removing ancillary navigation and focusing down?
I think you should take that one, Micah.
Okay. Well, you know, it's something that is pretty common in registration flows, for example. And I mean, I guess I don't know what the heart of your question is. If the question is this evil to do because people don't know where they are? Well, I think there's another question too, which is when am I entering the sales funnel, right? Like, what is the context? How far have I gone down my investigation or my consideration before I'm put into, you know, the cattle entrance? If it's something that, you know, if it's not a wall, if it's not a barrier to exploration, but I've gotten there and I've said, yes, I really want this, then to me it feels like a natural thing. You should, of course, always have clear access back out and to help. But I think, you know, removing distraction is generally a good thing.
I think it's interesting. I think as we've seen e-commerce evolve, 5 years ago,
I think the sales funnel would have started in the shopping cart, but increasingly it starts with checkout, right? That the shopping cart is it's just a holding area for decision making, right? And so you actually wanted to distract people with merchandising in the shopping cart, and it's in the checkout flow is when you really sell.
I think it's another really interesting example, though, where you might, again, of choosing one metric is a danger, right? Like, or the difference again between a metric and a goal, right? Because if your metric is, you know, a completion rate, then you may heavily optimize for that. But if your goal is overall revenue, then, you know, more aggressive merchandising through the sales process, you may lose more people, but you may generate more sales. And so it's a more complex analysis to understand the trade-offs. As designers, I think one of the challenges we have is we're often making trade-offs where on one side you have something very quantifiable, and then on the other side you have something that's harder to measure. And so that those can be harder.
It's actually a pretty good example of how A/B testing once saved the day. Was in Amazon, you're talking about the cart, and the story was that they said, well, once you're in your shopping cart, as soon as you add something to your shopping cart, we should give them recommendations. And of course, that idea got totally nixed. And until they came back and did some A/B testing on it that proved it was wildly successful, and they're leaving a huge chunk of change by not doing that. That's right, yeah.
And it's because their recommendations are good, right? If they weren't good, I think it'd be a different story. I am those other people. No, but in larger organizations, I think certainly I think in general, you have to have agreement of what's important, right? And not only what's important, but how to measure what's important. And often there's just a sense that you have to have sort of barometric readings of what's the general status of metrics, and then you have very targeted, whether it's A/B testing or product release, where you're doing very focused analytics around a particular topic or area. But like I said, I'm kind of doing all of that right now, but I think that you have to have agreement at the very foundation level of what's important and how to measure it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I work with kind of the analytics team that we have, and I think it's critical for them to be close partners in an A/B testing environment because, you need data pretty quickly, right? Certainly, if things go wrong, you want to be able to pull back on whatever you're doing. So they need to be aware of the tests you're running, and they need to be able to turn around the key data as quickly as possible. And so need to be involved kind of upfront in the process to understand what's required. And B, a lot of the time, they have an understanding of the metrics and of what impacts them that's kind of beyond what you can have from your limited area of expertise or your limited kind of sphere of ownership over the website. And so they can point out a lot of causality or probable causality for the metrics that you're seeing and saying, oh, you should check out whether this metric is lower, you should check out whether these are the types of things that also fell, or these are things that are not being found, or there's a bug in this area. Right, which is important as you're trying to track down why the metrics are different.
At eBay, we have there's a separate team involved with the metrics and analytics, and I think it's reminiscent of sort of how any larger company tends to sort of break out the more specialized roles. But I would reemphasize the need for having these things come together, and it's tough, especially at a larger company, because if they're separate groups and they can be more isolated. But it's really important because I think that the designers can also provide an insight, much like the metrics folks can provide their own insight. We can also provide an insight given the qualitative studies that we've done leading to this point. And then, in addition, I think we can help with also the presentation of the information. And that's one of the challenges that I've seen is that, you know, the business focus on the metrics, like that A/B, the deck that goes out about like what are the A/B test results is gold. And when it goes out, I mean, it spreads like wildfire. And if there isn't, you know, context provided, or if there isn't sort of especially the product design team sort of presentation incorporated, it can be challenging to sort of help to course correct some misinterpretations that can come out from seeing the metrics in isolation.
One other point I'd make on that is just that, particularly in large companies, there's generally no shortage of data, but there may be a shortage of insight, right?
Definitely.
Yes.
I think designers can help a lot in taking the data that is there, visualizing it, helping to tell a story about what it means. And I actually think that's part of the key to our success within the organization is going from being mock-up monkeys who are making 60 variations to saying, no, I understand the business, I understand what you're trying to do, and I can help you understand what we're learning even faster. And if I can make a quick plug, I've got myself and Andy Edmonds, who's sitting over there, are doing a core conversation talk tomorrow, Monday at 11:30. It's called Design Metrics Better Than Because I Said So, which is this panel's been focused very specifically on A/B testing, and we want to talk more generally about sort of tools for designers to use metrics to make better decisions.
Over there, question.
For us, A/B and multivariate have always been sort of the same thing. I've never actually had a test where there was just an A and just a B. It's always been a good 30 variants.
Yeah, same thing here.
The friend?
So usually when I've done it in the past, we've always had, our own way of doing it, right? And we split traffic, not necessarily 50-50 A/B or equally among the variants, right? But we carve out some piece of the traffic that goes to the multivariate test and that gets split among the variants. I haven't really seen us use any commercial packages available. Usually the analysis is pretty straightforward that you can do, especially if you have a couple of analysts that are skilled in sort of their standard statistical methods there. So typically, we kind of use our own site logic to split the traffic and then do our own analysis.
And I think it really just depends on your resources and what level of accuracy or risk you're willing to take. I mean, when I was at larger companies, yeah, we did the same thing. But now that there are only 50 of us, A, B, comma A works just as well, right? Turning something to something else for an hour because it's easiest for us to do, or pointing Australia, which has its own problems, of course, and then switching it back. I mean, that's because that's what we don't have time to even evaluate a package, or we can't consider doing something. And there's obviously noise because we're not doing a true A/B test, but I think that the data can be valuable regardless.
By the way, the one thing I just quickly chime in on that, the most value that I think the multivariate packages provide is in kind of test segment compression, I think it's called, right? So generating the test cells for a multivariate cells in the minimal amount of test cells necessary to actually test your full set of variations. That's actually pretty hard, right? Certainly if you have a lot of variations. So that's where a lot of the value is, and that's where I would still encourage people to use those packages especially if you don't have resources in-house that can do that.
I think we have time for one more question in the back.
So there was a brief period of time when I worked on a very long, complex selling process that the business contacts there were arguing for using a GOM style analysis to evaluate the different sales alternatives. We convinced them against doing that. We ended up taking a more holistic approach, and in that case, it turned out to be more effective. Now, like I know of other cases, for example, in the telecom industry, for example, where you've got a large number of people doing repetitive tasks again and again, where it has been shown to be quite effective. But it's the overhead; the tools are not really there yet, and it's pretty challenging to do with non-trivial tasks.
The variance that we've been more focused on, although what you bring up is interesting, it's been more around the different kind of personas that are involved with the site that we experience, they come to, and the thoughts around potentially having multiple design variants available depending on which persona we think that we would best cater to a certain design. So if somebody's brand new to the site and they've never been here before, maybe the emphasis through the there might be a design variant that emphasizes more about sort of assistive content and guides and things like that might be present versus somebody we know has been on our site for a long time. We might provide other sorts of information that's more emphasizing that, which an expert would be more familiar with and comfortable with. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you guys so much for coming. We appreciate it. And please fill out the surveys as well. They let us know how you liked it.